Hi, everyone. Welcome, everybody, to this forum of the Refugee Action Collective. My name's Benjamin. I've been involved in refugee activism since 2004. This forum is hosted by the Refugee Action Collective, which has existed since about 2001. It's a grassroots activist organisation that's open to participants from no matter the experience or no matter the level of experience, we're always looking for new activists. So tonight we're hosting an eyewitness forum of, I guess, what's going on Nauru, given that both the Labor government reopened Nauru and now Abbott controls Nauru and Manus Island. There's some really horrible stuff that's going on these islands, and so we've got some people who can speak in depth about what's going on. So our first speaker will be Muhammad Ali Zakiri, who is a refugee on Nauru in 2001 at the age of 10, and he's going to speak a bit about his experience.
Hey guys, so basically I just wanted to talk about my journey and how I got to Australia. I was 10 years old and I came with my brother and his family. There were 5 kids that my brother had, including me and another nephew of mine, which was from my other brother. So there were 7 of us who met our journey to come to Australia. So my brother sorted everything out with the smuggler. Back then we paid $16,000 in total to come to Australia. So he gave us passports and the smuggler and his representative helped us to get to Indonesia. And once in Indonesia we were just waiting for a boat so we could come to Australia, make our way to Australia for a new hope, for a new beginning. We stayed in Indonesia for around 6 months. We tried several times to get on a boat, but we were intercepted and stopped by the Indonesian police. And every time we were stopped, they would strip everything, like they would take all of our money. Plus, we didn't know how to speak Indonesian. It was really hard. So finally, we made our way to Australia. We were on a boat. It took us nearly 7 days to reach Australian water. And once we reached Australian water, what happened was that we were intercepted by the Navy ship of Australia. They told us that we have to go back. This was the time of John Howard. They told us to go back to Indonesia. There's no way that Australia is going to be accepting you guys. So, you know, everyone was panicking in the boat. They didn't know what to do. There were people that that was maybe their third time coming on a boat, and they were sent back. So what they did was someone started a fire on our boat. Mind you, there's women, children, there's over 100 people on the boat. So when the fire started on our boat, now everyone is panicking even more, people trying to shout. So now everyone is jumping in the water because the fire was spreading very fast. It took the Australian Navy ship nearly 2 hours to get us out of the water, because they were just waiting for a decision from upper level to stay and save them. They could have saved us, you know, they could have saved 2 people that got there. I witnessed one of the ladies who jumped in the water, and I saw her with my own eyes, you know. As a child, as a 10-year-old child, I saw her die right in front of me. So when they rescued us from the water, we stayed, we were in the Navy ship for another 10 days or even more, and then they took us to Christmas Island. Once they took us to Christmas Island, we were saved with the same clothes, we were within with the same clothes for nearly 2 months in Christmas Island. But back then, the detention centre was not even built properly. And what the Australian government did was that they told us, look, in order for you guys to come to Australia, you guys need to go to Nauru, and that way we can process your cases and your claims so you can go to Australia. I mean, we didn't know where Nauru was. We said, okay, we got happy, like, look, they're going to process our cases and we'll go to Australia. And once they took us to Nauru, we found out that everything was a lie. They kept us there for nearly 3 years. 3 years. And they didn't do anything, you know. There was no hope. They kept on telling us, look, there is no way that you guys will end up in Australia. You either go back or stay here forever. So people did a lot of demonstrations, peaceful demonstrations, but our voices were not heard by anyone because we were really far away. At one stage, when we got to Nauru, the first of our cases, our friends, out of 1,200 people, there were around 25 people that were accepted as genuine refugees. The rest, over 1,000 people, were not genuine refugees. I mean, why would they risk their lives and come to Australia if they're not genuine refugees? So what happened was that the Australian government introduced a $2,000 bribe for those who could take that money and go back to Afghanistan or wherever their countries are, like Iran. So people that had no choice but to go and protect their family, they took that $2,000 and went back. And there were more than 100 people that took that money and went back to Afghanistan. And out of those 100 people, I know over 20 people have been killed by the Taliban. And the rich people like us, we stayed there. We had no other choice. We stayed there and we made a hunger strike. You know, we made a hunger strike where there were a couple of people who fished their lips. And this way, the hunger strike went for 3 weeks, and every week people would join in to make it bigger. And this way, it got on the news, and people started talking about it in Australia. And that's how, you know, after the hunger strike, they told us, look, you guys are all accepted to Australia. I mean, there were people there that were happy and sad at the same time. They said, why didn't you do this at the first place when we got here? Why did you keep us here for nearly 3 years, and now you think we're just general refugees? What for? We spent 3 years in Nauru. You know the situation, the condition of the detention center is horrible. As a child, I witnessed people trying to commit suicide. People reading suicide notes. I remember a guy who died within the detention center of a heart attack. People with mental illnesses, lack of medical treatment, you know, like, okay, you go to the doctors and there's lack of medical assistance, you don't know what to do. Dengue, malaria, all this would spread. The heat up there was crazy, over 40 degrees, you know, every day, and we didn't have any air conditioner or anything. We were just surrounded by fences and rocks. I mean, people who live in Nauru, they're all at the coastal areas, you know, they live near the sea, but whereas us, the government of, Nauru has given all this phosphate to Australia. It's all like rocks everywhere, so we were right in the middle of Nauru, where the heat was even worse. They brought us, after nearly 3 years, they brought us to Australia, and I remember when I first came to Australia, everything was different for me. I mean, I had to adapt to a new style. I couldn't speak English when I came to Australia, and I had to work my way through. Communication was my biggest barrier. I went to high school. I've never done primary school in my life. I went to high school, I was isolated. I couldn't make any friends at all. People bullying me, people telling me to go back to the country. I mean, I had to ignore that, because I've seen worse than that. I made communication my main priority and kept on studying, you know, like, even at one stage in year 12, I was one of the school captains at high school. I did my exams. Before even doing my final exam to get my ATAR, I was accepted doing a course in pharmacy, but I waited and did my exam and got into law. So at the moment I'm doing law and business, a double degree at Victoria University. I'm contributing as much as any other citizen of this country is contributing to this economy. When I'm working, I'm paying my taxes. My brother, who came here with nothing, he owns a farm in Shepparton and he employs people from the community. We are working really hard in order to build this country, and we are really proud of it. But I'm ashamed of what the Australian government is doing at the moment with all these refugees. The Western tax people, all the taxpayers' money, all the big businesses getting all that money, whereas all this inhuman treatment of refugees, I mean the debt of Mirza Farad. It has been 70 days till today. There has been no answer from anyone. No one has answered anything about who murdered him. Scott Morrison, he's denying everything. Tony Abbott, he doesn't care. He just wants refugees. I mean, if you look at the end of the thousand people that have died, you know, all the way to making to come to Australia and make the journey, who's responsible for this? This government is responsible for this. Labour introduced this, but now Liberals are taking the lead on even becoming worse. Australia is supposed to be a role model towards other country, other nations, but instead they're dumping their responsibilities on other nations. Why are we doing this? Australia says a fair go, but where is that fair go? I don't see that. I mean, is it trying to seek asylum? It's not. My country has been in civil war for more than 2 decades. Yet Australia and other nations around the world, they're sending their troops to Afghanistan, and yet they say there's peace. Why are you trying to send your soldiers when you think there's peace? You're trying to dislocate other people from within the community, and when they come for help to come to Australia, you close your doors and you treat them like animals? Is that how you do it? I mean, as I said, I'm really ashamed of all the things that this government is doing. Like, we only come with hope to reach Australia. And, you know, we make that journey, we go through all that, you know, danger on the way. I mean, why would my nephew, when we were in the boat, my nephew was unconscious for 6 hours. I mean, he was a one-year-old baby. I mean, why would my brother risk his children's life and us and come on a leaky boat to Australia and end up in a detention centre? Obviously, there's something wrong in our country. We are trying to flee persecution and war, and yet this government is not doing anything, whereas still they're trying to deny people from entering and, again, putting people in detention centres where they... You know, all those have a lot of impact, people in the detention centres. When they come to Australia, they will go through depression, anxiety, any sort of mental illnesses that you can think about. I mean, why would a person, for instance me, if I had safety in my country, I would stay there? Why would I want to leave my identity and belonging and travel to a new country where I have to start from fresh? Would you do that? No. I would not do it. But since I have no choice, I had to do it. And plus, you know, all the people that come to Australia, like me, thousands of others, they are doing something for the community. They're making a difference. You know, we're helping build this country. And we are Australians too now. Let's not forget the fact that this country does not belong to us. We all must tell you it belongs to the indigenous people of Australia. They're the truly people who deserve to be in this country. And if they say to me, look, you're not allowed to come to my country, I'll be like, look, you have a fair go. But if someone else is trying to tell you that, look, you're coming to this country and you're doing this, it's not fair at all. Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Mohammed. One thing to add is that we'll have time for questions and discussion, but we'll leave that until after all the speakers have had time to speak. Our next speaker is Samira Salavati Najed, who's from Iran, and she's going to speak about her parents and her sister who are currently on Nauru. Welcome.
Hello everyone, my name is Samira. I am from Iran. First of all, I'm very grateful to everyone for giving me this chance that I can speak and I can empty myself. Right now, I feel a very, very heavy burden on my shoulders because of my family. My family is my father, my mother, they are like 50 plus, and my sister. They reached to Christmas Island, you can say before 19, when the policy was not in release. But because of the Navy, who just record the time later on, at 19, they stayed for 2 months on Christmas Island. And every day they used to be tortured by the immigration. Every day immigration used to go to them and say to them, you have to go to the Maldives. It was like a torture for them every 24 hours. They couldn't sleep properly, they couldn't talk properly. I remember those days, they were very sad. Sometimes they used to call me. I remember when it was the last day when they were in Christmas Island, they called me and they said that, we are happy. We had an interview with immigration. Immigration officer said us that, I feel so sorry for your family. You have been through so many, like, bad situation in your life. I wish I can do something for you. My family were very happy that day. They said, we feel that immigration is going to give us a chance to stay in Australia. Both the family, me and my brother, we were happy in Melbourne, and they were happy over there. Next day, when I was waiting for their call, they didn't call me. For 10 days, I was waiting for their call. They didn't call me. Like, I was feeling that my family had been happiest from the world. It was the worst condition in my life. When I remember it all, I want to kill myself. I was feeling that I am not going to see any of my family members, I mean, including my father, my mother, and my sister anymore. They were disappeared. No card, no email for 10 days. I was like a body. I was in my room. I couldn't sleep, I couldn't eat anything, and I had no clue to just find out about them. After 10 days, when like I was thinking, what can I do? Me, my brother, we, all the night, we were just crying. We couldn't eat anything. I am the eldest child of my family, and my younger brother is staying with me. He is the youngest child of my family. Like, one, it was after 10 days, I received the call. It was my mother. When I remember that time, that moment, if everyone is asking me what is the best moment of your life, I am saying the moment that my mother called me and I heard her voice. It's like that God has given me new life. God has given me new chance. I just remember I was very happy. I was jumping, I was just screaming, and I was telling my mother, I am happy that you are alive. Why? I said, I am so sorry. They have taken you tomorrow. My mother said, listen, Samira, they haven't taken us tomorrow. I have been admitted in hospital in a city near to the pair in ICU for 4 days. My mother, due to, like, she's a hypersensitive patient. They, next day after the interview, the immigration went to the early morning at 4 a.m. They just knocked their room and they said, get up, you have to go to the north. Then they were not expecting that. They were happy that my family is unit, extreme unit again. Then my mother's like blood pressure shooted up and like she fainted, she was unconscious, and they kept her in a like ICU for 4 days. And the doctor said, you are lucky. If she was late, she was about to have like brain effort, and she should have been paralyzed forever. After that, my mother cannot walk on her left leg. After when she was discharged from the hospital, they took her to Derby. They kept her in detention center in Derby for 3-4 days, and then they transferred them again to Nauru. And since 10 months ago, my family, they have been in Nauru. My father, 2 months ago, he's a cardio patient. He came today's emergency transfer into the Brisbane. He had his cardio surgery 2 months ago in Greenslope Hospital. I went there, I saw my father. I didn't know I should be happy or I should be sad to see my father, because I was not expecting to see him after long time, or I should see him in the like hospital there. So after he was done with his surgery, they just took him to the camp in Brisbane. He stayed there for just 2-3 weeks, and they transferred him back tomorrow. Since he's back tomorrow, his final symptoms are back. He cannot breathe. He is suffering from severe asthma, and for last 2-3 weeks, in the beginning, he used to be admitted in hospital for 3 days, for 4 days, and since last 10 days, they have isolated him from the tent. They said he shouldn't go back to the tent because he's allergic to the weather. Otherwise, he's going to lose his lungs. And daily, he has to be nebulized by oxygen. Now they have isolated him and he's staying in a room next to the hospital for urgent treatment. This is what is happening with my father. My sister is suffering from severe kidney infection for last 4 months and they are giving him antibiotics for last 4 months. Plus she is suffering from kidney stone. She's telling me that daily they are giving her injection, morphine injection. That is very unfair. Plus giving very, very strong pain killers. She says her doctor, whenever she sees her, the doctor tells her that immigration has to send you to Australia for the proper treatment. We cannot give you proper treatment over here. And I have sent so many letters to the immigration, but immigration is delaying that, for what, I don't know. This is what is happening with my sister. And my mother, because of what happened to her when she was in, like, Christmas Island, she cannot walk in her left leg. And she has to use a crutch while walking on the road in the detention center. This is what has happened to my family. My family is lucky because they have me. Because now I am revealing what is happening to them. But I feel sorry for those families who have no one over here, or no one can talk about what is happening with them. As for the latest thing that I heard from my sister, she said immigration 2-3 days ago, intentionally, they disconnected the water on everyone to just giving them tough time, to just making them to go back to their home country. People, they stop eating, they stop drinking to avoid going to toilet. It's like people daily, they are getting infection, they are getting every problem and no one cares them. My family, in my family, we are educated. I am a pharmacist, my sister is a psychologist. My brothers are engineers and my family used to be teachers. We have never helped anyone in our life. We didn't come to Australia to harm anyone. As far as I remember from my childhood, I grew up in this country or in a society that we were deprived of humanity and human rights. Now I am happy I live in a country that I have freedom of speech. I can talk. I can just empty myself. I can just release this burden which is on my shoulders. But I have grown up in a society and in a country that they have always shouted me down. But I want to tell that me and my family and the other people who are staying in detention camp, they deserve humanity. They deserve human rights. And we want to live in a peaceful and secure land where we feel we deserve it. And we want to be treated like human beings. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Our next speaker is Mark Isaac. Mark Isaac is a former caseworker on Nauru who works for the Salvation Army and has recently written and launched a book which is called The Undesirable. We have copies for sale up at the store at the back. So welcome, Mark.
Hi there. Thank you very much for having me. It's an honour and a privilege to share my story and to share the stories of the men that I work with in Nauru. My story is very different to the last two speakers. I come from an Australian background. The only reason I ever got invested in this debate and in this issue was to try and meet a girl. I was writing articles for Oxfam. Can you use the microphone? Is that better? Okay, so my story is very different to the last two speakers. I grew up in Australia and I only became invested in the scientific debate to meet a girl. And it was, I was writing for Oxfam and I was doing social justice articles and there was a very pretty girl who I worked with and her mother took people to the detention centre in Sydney to meet asylum seekers. And I remember telling her, yeah, I'd love to go, I'm really interested in asylum seekers. And so I went along to meet the mum to get closer to the girl. And at that stage, I was a 24-year-old graduate from Amos University degree. I had no real knowledge about asylum seekers or refugees or their stories. And I had no knowledge about what Australia and how Australia treated asylum seekers and refugees. Pretty much all I'd heard was from media, things like illegal immigrants or queue jumpers or all that kind of jargon. And so when I arrived at the detention centre, I was shocked to find this more or less what was a prison. I had a barbed wire fencing, security gates, metal detectors, and the first man I met had rope bands around his neck in Tamil Sri Lankan, and he had attempted suicide a few days earlier because he gave a negative assessment of his refugee status. And I guess the implication is he'd rather attempt suicide than go back to his country. And that was the first time I'd ever seen someone who'd attempted suicide before. So that really is quite confronting. And then I remember thinking, I had no, I guess, nothing to say to these men. I had nothing in common with them. I had no idea about their stories. I didn't know what I could give them. I didn't know what I was doing there. And so the next man I met was a man of my age. And so I talked to him about something that I thought we could have in common, which was girls. And he said, yeah, I had a girlfriend. And I said, yeah, what happened to her? And he said, she got murdered in Sri Lanka. And so another statement that I've never, I guess, been confronted with before. And it dawned on me that this was going to be a very harrowing experience. In the next 3 hours, I met a number of men from Rohingya men from Burma, Tamil men from Sri Lanka, Iraqis, Iranians. Stories that differed in detail, but not in tragedy. But what struck me most of all about this tragic situation was these men were in a little detention centre waiting for the refugee status to be processed. And they had no idea of when that would happen and what would happen when they were processed. And they'd been there for years. And their days consisted of endless games of ping pong. They had nothing to do, nowhere to be, with no knowledge of what would happen to them. And that was what was driving them crazy. I remember walking away from there extremely exhausted and drained, wondering why the system was like it was, and why these people, if they weren't refugees, why weren't they told they weren't refugees, so they could then, you know, go back to their countries, and if they were refugees, why weren't they processed in a timely fashion? So I wrote an article for Oxfam, and I guess I continued on with my life for several months, until a friend of mine who read that article told me that the Salvation Army were hiring people to go to Nauru, and the Pacific Solution was being reintroduced, and an expert panel had been set up actually in Hilal to confront this issue, or apparently this issue, of people drowning at sea. And so on one side they were saying we need to help stop people drowning at sea, we need to stop the boats to save lives. But on the other side we had an expert panel saying referring to this policy as a no-advantage policy that was to give those who came by boat no advantage over those who came by the correct channels. For me, there's an instant contradiction there. Are we going to try and save these people's lives, or are we punishing them for going by a channel that isn't correct? But at that stage, I didn't really know much about the issue, I didn't know much about asylum seekers, and I took on the job more out of curiosity and sense of adventure, because I wanted to see just how bad this policy could get, and I wanted to witness what would potentially be something quite extreme in Australian immigration history. So I said, yeah, sure, and I rang up the Salvation Army, and I literally said, I would like to go to Nauru, and the conversation followed. She said, yes, when you can leave. And within a week, I was in Nauru, not having had an interview, and it's the first job I've ever gotten without an interview. Having done a few medical checks, and then that was it. And I was flying off to Nauru, one of the harder experiences of my life. And getting on that plane, I thought, I wonder who the hell is going to be working for the Salvation Army. And I had this image of retirees going to preach to me all trip. And the first person I met was actually wearing a safari suit. And he looked ridiculous. And I thought, what have I got myself into? The next woman I met didn't know what an asylum seeker was. And so there was quite a lot of apprehension that I arrived in that room. And I remember one of the men describing it to me, when you arrived in that room, he thought he was landing in water, because the island is so small it actually disappears as you arrive by plane. It's a very small island. It's about 20 minutes around by car. The main road closes when planes come in because it more or less lands on the main road. Around the outer edges of the paradise islands, paradise beaches, say, palm trees, coconuts. However, as you look closer, you realise it's a very poor country, and the country actually relies on Australian government aid to support it. So you can imagine when the government offered $3 billion, $4 billion a year to take on a couple of hundred asylum seekers, they jumped at the chance. Outside of that, so within those paradise beaches, you've got more or less an island of mined out phosphate rock, and it is extremely hot. As Mohammed said, extremely hot. So the minute you walk off the plane, you're sweating. And within that mined out phosphate rock in the centre of the island, it was housed an area detention centre that I worked at. In terms of the conditions for the workers, we were housed in the very first time I worked there. The conditions have altered and changed numerous times throughout the time I worked there and since I've left. So everything that I say here is just my experiences. But when we first arrived there, we would have 10 men to 2 rooms in a hotel room with one bathroom. And it was cozy. You got to know each other quite well. And considering we're all in shift work, that would mean you'd be woken up at all hours. If you're in a night shift, people would be trooping in while you're trying to sleep. And most oppressive of all was this idea that the media was banned from coming into the detention centre. And we were told to sign confidentiality and contracts that would state that we could not talk to anyone about anything that had happened in the camp at all times. We were told that if we emailed our loved ones back at home on Facebook comments that were politically, affiliated in any way, if we had any kind of public presence that talked about Nauru, the ASIO would be checking it and we would be told and we would be kicked off the island. And in fact, we did have a girl who placed a political comment on Twitter and was fired for it. And so with this backdrop of this overarching thing that the government is watching you, we were expected to work in Nauru. When we first went to camp, it was rudimentary at best. It was purposely disorganised and purposely underprepared to meet these men's needs. And the reason why I said purposely is because when a government sends several hundred people to an island, you'd expect it to be ready, you'd expect the Salvation Army to know what was going on, you'd expect there'd be some kind of buildings in place, but that was not what we found. Men were housed in dark green army tents at least 50 degrees Celsius in the heat. During the rainy season, the wet season, the camp would flood, and sometimes it was up to our knees. The camp was rock terrain, and so with this heat and the bouncing off the rock, it was again extremely hot, and it was very small. There was cramped into these rudimentary conditions, with about 6 to 8 men to a tent, sleeping on stretcher beds. And then above all, there was nothing to do, yet again. So the first day I arrived in Nauru, the Salvation Army had no job description, no mission brief, no aim as to what they were doing there or how we would achieve this aim that wasn't given to us. And we were told to literally go out and help the men. And so when we walked into that camp and we met these men who had been taken from Christmas Island and brought into Nauru on plane, the first thing they asked us was, what are we doing here? Where is this place? Why are we here and how long will we be here? And to every single question, all I could answer was, I don't know. And I realised just how underprepared we were to meet these men's needs. The men told us that they were brought to Nauru, they were told when they were leaving Christmas Island that they were just changing rooms. and then they were put on a plane. Some were told that they'd be going to Australia, and some were taken forcibly, but some said in handcuffs. When they arrived in Nauru, a lot of them realised that they were more or less in the middle of nowhere, and when they were told that they didn't know how long they would be there and what would happen to them, a lot of them broke down and cried. This camp, for me personally, I saw a need to give these guys something to do. So my role throughout the time I was there was creating a recreation program. And within this program, I got to know the men very well. I met Tamilmen from Sri Lanka who complained of the civil war that they were fleeing from and the persecution they suffered at the hands of the Sinhalese government. I met Iraqi men who were fleeing the aftermath of the war that decimated their country and were fleeing from militia that were targeting whoever and whenever. I met Hazara men who fled from Afghanistan and Pakistan, fleeing from a persecution that killed many Hazaras. And I met Iranian men who were fleeing from what they told me, religious persecution, persecution against homosexuality, and a lot of other types of persecution that I'd never been aware of before I'd been to this island. And as I got to meet these men, I started to really become friends with them, and I got to see the resilience that these people had by coming across some of these boats, and from the stories they told me, things and hardships that I would never have to face, I hope, and probably will never face. I think what struck me most about this camp was this idea of with a criminal, you give him a sentence, and he can serve that sentence, and he can say it up to 10 years' time, he will be able to plan his future and say, 10 years' time I'll be out and I can do this and I can see my family again. And I guess there's an idea that you're supposed to rehabilitate in that time. For these men who have not committed a crime and are seeking asylum, they have no sentence. And they're there indefinitely, and they can't see anyone in sight, and they don't know when they can leave, and they can't tell what their family at home when they'll be able to help them. From the time I was there until now, not one asylum seeker that I've met has been processed as a refugee. And the question I would pose to the government is, if these people are not refugees, and they are, jerking the system in some way, why don't we hear their claims, have their refugee status determined, and then deal with them? Why is the government banned from going into this camp? Why is the media banned from going into this camp? Why, if we are saving lives at sea and upholding this as a policy that's humanitarian, why is every humanitarian organisation condemning it? And why is every other country wondering, even China, wondering why we're treating these people like this? I began writing this book not as a way of advocating for them, and it actually started as a way of processing what I was seeing for myself. And it happened on a night when a man I knew quite well, who was an Iranian Kurd, considered stateless, he told me, due to his ethnicity. He had a story where he came over from Iran to help his family. He had a wife and kids at home. And essentially that's more or less what all he's been doing, coming over here as a vanguard for families to make a better life for themselves or through this persecution. And they told him that he'd taken their money and he wouldn't be coming back and he'd been settled in Australia because they didn't understand what this policy was and they didn't understand what Nauru was. And they told him that his wife told him that she was going to leave him. And once that happened, he had nothing. He had no reason to be here. The whole reason he had come from Iran to Australia was to help his family, and now he was stuck in the middle of nowhere with no future, really. And so he attempted to take his life using one of the cords from one of the tents. And in the aftermath of that attempt at suicide, I went into the camp to talk to his friends and my friends, and I guess, provide some comfort. And I was met by the forefront of the injustice and the grief and the anger these men were feeling, and essentially that was our job as missionaries between the Salvation Army and every person here, and I think including the work we've been in for the Salvation Army in Nauru. Regardless of how we see the organisation and the way the organisation treats these men, the workers I worked with had utmost care and utmost respect for these men, and we were constantly on the forefront of most of the emotions that we felt that the politicians who have been creating this policy and the people who voted for this policy should be saying if they really believe in a deterrence policy. And so I talked to these men and I was accused that it was of this attempted suicide being my fault. And there was nothing I could say that would, and nothing I could feel that would say it wasn't, because essentially this is my country, my people, and our policy, and we were sending these people to this detention centre. And by doing so, we had called this man free. And that's how I felt the time. And it was extremely emotional evening. And I walked out of that camp with a horrible feeling, because I knew walking out of that camp that those men would follow me and that they would be stuck there. So by obeying and avoiding that grief, it was an awful sensation. And so I went back and wrote out a chapter in the book. And I haven't changed that chapter since I wrote it, and it stays in there. And it helped me come to terms with what I've seen, and slowly I started building up a collection of these writings, of the more, I guess, enhanced emotions, whether it be happy or sad, because there were some great moments as well. And coming back from Nauru and trying to reconnect with my friends and family, it was an extremely difficult task, because how do you sum up everything that I've seen and done, in two words? I was Nauru. And so it was only through showing them my writings that I could see that they understood what was happening, and they got an understanding and a window into this dark and horrible world. And so I composed this book and wrote as much as I could and recorded everything that I saw. And this book is written for those men and for other asylum seekers who are in Nauru. And I guess for the Australian people to see, you know, you can agree with this policy or you can't, but at least know what this policy is. And this is the reality of the deterrence policy. And if you want to know what the reality is and you want to stand by that reality, please read this. Thank you.
Just before we have our final speaker, just a few announcements, I guess. The Refugee Action Collective has regular meetings on Monday nights at 6:30 at the Australian Nurses Federation. And if you're interested in getting involved, there's a sign-up sheet up the back. I think Chris is going to pass it around. And up the back, check out our store. We have the Undesirables book for sale, as well as another book, A Country Too Far. We have t-shirts for sale and there's some leaflets about some of our upcoming events. There's also a petition to sign against the indefinite detention of refugees at Broadmeadows Detention Centre. If people could sign that would be a big help. And the last thing to announce is that on Wednesday, the 28th of May, there's going to be a protest because it's the 100th day since Reza Barati was murdered on Manus Island, and so we're calling for an independent investigation to close Manus Island and sack Scott Morrison, and that's going to be at the Immigration Department at 12:30. I don't think do we have leaflets for that? No, we don't have leaflets for that. But come up, take a photo of it or something, and we'll keep down the details and come along to that. So our last speaker is Jasmine Ali. She's been involved in the Refugee Action Collective for the last few years. Welcome, Jasmine.
Firstly, I just wanted to thank all the speakers today, because I think the stories that we're hearing tonight are exactly the story that Abbott and Morrison don't want us to hear. You know, it's the real face, the real humanity of what's going on. But the question for us, I think, when confronted with this is what can we do? What can we do to change this policy? And I think it's very important for us, I think, when we're, you know, the coverage of the refugee issue that we're presented with. Morrison and Abbott present themselves time and time again with a great deal of hubris, a great deal of confidence that this is a policy of success, of strength, that they're able to actually to keep people out of Australia, to keep refugees who are coming here seeking safety and seeking protection outside of the border. And as Mohammed said, the heart of this argument is the argument that the Australian government will not take any responsibility, right? It will shift the burden wherever it can, whether it's to Nauru, whether it's to Manus, and whether what I'm going to talk about a bit later on is that they've just announced in Cambodia, a plan to now resettle to refugees in places anywhere, basically, other than Australia. But I think we have to recognise something at the heart of this, that even though there's a great deal of hubris about what they're saying, this policy is one that's absolutely in tatters. You look at every single time they try to implement and deal with the question, the concrete question, where are people going to be processed? Where are people actually going to be resettled? There aren't any answers to this. Every single time that they try and actually deal with this issue concretely, there are problems that basically create the crises that we've seen that Mark writes about very distinctively in his book. You know, the pressure cooker situation in Nauru is very much the consequence of this policy that's ridden with problems from the very get-go. Firstly, just in terms of processing, Mark mentioned it before, right? Since we've had Nauru, since we've had Manus Island, not one refugee has been processed, right? Not one. That's months and months and months of waiting with not even a process. There are a few refugees who have had some interviews, but none have been processed. And I think this is, again, this creates problems for the government. The issue about Nauru. Nauru just recently announced, the Nauruan government, that it's actually not going to resettle. It's not going to resettle any refugees, right? Again, this forces a crisis upon the government about what is it actually going to do. It's trying to push people out, but the reality is that countries other than Australia are in a worse situation in order to be able to take them, offer protection and offer safety. I think the most stark example, though, is Manus Island. We've seen both the practical and political problems of Manus Island. Mohammed mentioned, right, what's happened to Reza Barati, right? There's been no charges on the killers. Actually, the murderers of Reza Barati are working back inside the detention centre as we speak. Transfield knows about it, they're on the payroll, the Australian government knows about it, but nothing has been done and they won't do anything about it. The political problems, I think, are also there in terms of that they can't actually run the centre. I mean, this is how much of a crisis it is on Manus Island. There are reminders every day in the newspaper about the details that emerge from what actually happened inside, right? The fact that there are machete holes, right, on the doors of asylum seekers in the centre. The fact that there's blood splattering across the wall. These very, very stark facts about actually what went on, exposing the lies, that asylum seekers were attacked, right? This wasn't a riot in that way. They were physically attacked and the imposition of the policy on Manus Island is the heart of what's created that. So this has created a situation that it's actually very extremely unlikely, because of these tensions, that people, again, can actually be resettled on Manus Island. And these things inflict a major blow to their agenda, their project of wanting to maintain offshore processing and this idea of deterrence that underpins all of it. But I think what's important to recognise, although there are these problems, there are cracks, there are divisions in the policy, it doesn't mean that Abbott and Morrison are going to retreat. In fact, what we've seen is the opposite. They've become more aggressive, more willing to actually attack the rights of refugees, and to try and escalate the measures of deterrence that we've already seen. So again, Julie Bishop, the Foreign Minister, she's been over to Cambodia to talk about another plan to paper over the cracks of the offshore detention policy. But again, even before this has started, there's already issues, right? The UNHCR has said this is going to be a gross violation, again, another one. I mean, there's so many to count in terms of the Australian government's record on refugee rights, but another violation, again, as a marker of the refugee convention. Cambodia, again, there are more different problems, another set of problems with Cambodia in terms of what the government wants to do with it. It is less dependent on Australian aid than Nauru and Manus Island, and that means, in terms of the Australian government, Morrison and Abbott being able to wield its might and say, we want you to do this, it's going to be far more difficult for them to get away with it. But I think it's important, though, to recognise, even within the country, the deep political turmoil that exists in Cambodia. I mean, it's not very long ago that Cambodia has been dealing with its own decades of civil war, and it's still dealing with the strife at the moment. I mean, I have a sister-in-law who's actually refugee background from Cambodia. I mean, the detail of the horror of what went on during that civil war, those consequences still continue today. So I think it is very important to recognise that despite this confidence that everything's going fine, they're stopping the boats, there's a great deal of cracks in the policy. And that is something that we need to recognise as a refugee movement. We have to seize those cracks. We have to widen them. We have to, in that way, the crisis that's happening in offshore detention, we need to double our efforts here outside the detention centres to actually force and push them open as possible. And I think we can be confident right now. I mean, there is a growing sense that the movement is broadening. I mean, in the last week while I was just in Melbourne, right, we've had demonstrations of thousands of people. 10,000 people was the estimate from a couple of weeks ago with Palm Sunday. Looking over the country nationally, right, this isn't just located or restricted to Melbourne. Thousands of people turned out to all different city centres to note their opposition, to say, actually, this isn't our policy. Right, we don't want the government to go ahead with this. That's their policy, it's their agenda of stopping the boats, and we want to welcome refugees. And I think that's a very important marker. But I think another significant thing about this growing mood, I guess if you like, and growing political mobilisation, is that it's becoming a lot more broad. There were big sections of church congregations at the rallies. In Sydney, there are about 13 unions represented in a contingent of unions for refugees. For people who have been involved in the refugee movement for quite a while, this is a change. You know, things are shifting. And I think it's important to note as well, this pressure is putting pressure on the government. You can think about Sue Lyons, the WA Perth senator, who came out to note that there are a number of Labor politicians who are now speaking out, and they wanted a movement for changes in Labor. That would have not been possible had there not been the growing sense of opposition and mobilisation to the policy to push the issue of welcoming refugees into the Australian Parliament. But we're going to need a movement outside of Parliament to really deal a massive blow, a major blow to this policy and force the Labor government to change its policy and isolate the most rabid and aggressive, not nature, but whole ideology that underpins deterrence and anti-refugee policies of the coalition. So I think just to finish on what kind of movement, at the heart of this has to be an argument about there isn't a refugee problem in Australia. There's a political problem in Australia, right? You think about the fact that Australia is the most resourced country in the region. It takes a tiny proportion of refugees. The government should be welcoming the boats, not deterring them. You can see just very recently with the budget, there's more money, there's $24 billion that they're willing to spend on joint strategic planes, yet they're not willing to actually fund the kind of policies that could actually bring people directly from Indonesia, resettle people in the community, and provide them with assistance. So I think there's probably one last thing in terms of a key task. I think shifting public opinion is also very important. I mean, people have cited a lot the poll that got taken in January that said that about 60% of the population wanted harder or harsher measures against refugees. And Morrison has used it. He's used this poll to say that the Australian, this is a policy that the Australian public support, the Australian community support. Well, I think we have to be very critical of this poll actually, because the question that it puts, that is put to people is whether or not they think harsher measures should be given to people coming by boat, right? It's not a poll that is about whether they think people are refugees. It's assumed, the argument that's assumed is that they're not refugees, so they deserve harsher treatment. So our key task is actually winning that argument and shifting the public opinion that actually people come by boat are refugees. And I think you would find that if you took a poll, actually, if people are coming by refugees, do they deserve harsher measures? Well, in the past, you've seen people in the Australian community actually say no to a great deal of that. But that 40% anyway, there's 40% of people in the Australian population that actually think that refugees should be welcomed. That's a solid bedrock to go out there and build a movement to deepen it into the communities, into the trade unions, into the suburbs, in the workplaces, and really push this back. I think the recent mobilisation we're seeing, we should go out with every confidence at this particular time. We can end offshore processing, we can push back the racism, and we can end the fear.
So now we have some, some time for discussion. Feel free to stick up your hand to offer, ask some questions or maybe have comments. I'll keep people to 3 minutes so everyone has a chance to speak. But yeah, stick up your hands and I'll call people. Stephen? Yep.
I mean, as a child, I basically lost my own childhood when I was in the detention center. I could have done so many other things within that 3 years. You know, within that 3 years, I could have came and studied. You know, I could have done primary school. Doing 3 years in primary school, that's a lot of time. You can learn a lot of language. You know, when you're young, you can learn the language fast. But when you grow older, it gets harder for you, you know. But the emotional feeling, you know, thinking, when you get out of that detention center, there's a big burden on you to learn the language. To try and be a part of a group that you're not, you know. It takes a lot of time and effort in order to be a part of that group. Because through this process, you go through a lot of depression, anxiety, all sorts of mental illnesses. And there are a lot of people that, you know, they can't adapt to the way of lifestyle here. They cannot learn the language, but still they're trying their best. One of the key advantages would be that those children within the detention centre, take them out of there and put them somewhere to give them education so they can learn. And as soon as they come here, you know, when their claims are processed, they can come here and they could be part of a group, you know, they could be already there instead of going through the difficulties of isolation or depression in order to get there.
Mohan? Ilya?
Just to follow on from the comments that Jeff was making in terms of public opinion and using and mobilizing the surging of the tide, which I believe that's happening with the rest of the Iraqi and the victims that were held across Australia, 200 victims, which brought out over 70,000 people. I think the time is right for all of us here to use the opportunity that mobilizing community backlash to the cruel and inhumane and prejudiced policies that both labor and liberals have perpetuated and to persecute different people seeking freedom and peace. And protection in Australia. And I just want to say that who at the extreme movement told me was clearly wrong, and all the suggestions that you were talking about, Jasmine, in terms of spreading the word in our workplace, in our schools, in our clubs, in our associations, with the churches, with the unions, is actually starting to gain traction. And the successful demonstrations and Sunday walks illustrate that we can turn the tide and we can get positive change. But I'd just like to ask a question of the panel, and that is the reason why Australia has been able to perpetuate it and this horrible policy against child migrants and the refugees, because Australia does not have a bill of rights. And I believe that we as a country need to lobby for an adoption of a bill of rights which would prevent any government from treating child migrants so inhumanely and from imprisoning them and cruelly preventing or keeping them in indefinite detention. So I'd like to get your comments about progressing public movement for Australia to get a bill of rights.
Well, I definitely agree with you. I think the Bill of Rights is extremely important, and I think it's essential for the human protection is shown. At the same time, I'd like to think that we can change this without a Bill of Rights, and I'd like to think that our government and our people believe in human rights without having to enforce that. Having said that, let's bring a Bill of Rights movement to it. It might not be my particular battle, but yeah, I'd definitely encourage it.
What I believe in that situation is for a Bill of Rights in order to be employed to become a law, or we have a Bill of Rights, it's going to take a lot of time. The process is going to be a long, lengthy one, and there's going to be a lot of issues with you have to go to the Republic, and the time is really time consuming. I mean, we have implied rights, but they're not enough. We should have a Bill of Rights, but the only problem is it's a very lengthy time to get there.
You guys want to respond to that?
I'd say a few things, but I'd like to hear what other people think as well. But just briefly on the Bill of Rights, I think, obviously any laws that hold the government to account about what they're doing are good, but ultimately at the end of the day you can see the amount of legislation we have. The International Convention has basically considered refugees have the right to come to Australia, but there are always loopholes around these legal avenues that the government gets around in order to pursue their projects. So ultimately I think the biggest counterweight that we can have to what they're doing is like I'm saying, the public pressure outside.
Yeah, just done something.
Having spent 40 plus years growing up in the United States, I'm not sure my first thought is right to solve any problems, because there isn't the degree of tension to raise Australia this year. For example, I would say that the increased immigration today still leaves me with any more favor than we do here. The biggest problem there is the spending of the single-word direction, whether it's for the state, Mexican, or whatever the nationality might be. And, they've got their own problems in places like Guantanamo Bay, for example. So I'm not sure it's so right to solve the problem.
Again, I think Bill of Rights is great, but what needs to change is the attitude towards human rights.
Mm-hmm.
And at the moment, this isn't a political issue, this isn't left versus right, this isn't Labour versus Liberal, this is a human rights issue, and I've been accused of being a hippie and a communist, because... yeah, but the idea is that because I'm believing in human rights, because I'm championing human rights, I'm suddenly a hippie and a communist. And I don't understand where political stance comes into this when all I'm doing is saying these people need to be protected. And I think whether you get a Bill of Rights or not, this isn't about that. It's about the issue that asylum seekers are facing.
Yep, up the back.
What is it true that you have been doing since mobilization over the last couple of months? How they work with the quite arrogant
Campbell and so on. But So the first question was about the confidentiality I signed in the contract. So for me personally, there's been no kind of backlash as of yet. That's not to say that there won't be. I was advised that from several different lawyers, each lawyer gave me a different, analysis of it. One lawyer told me that there was potential jail time for breaking contracts. But in discussing it with other lawyers, it comes down to how would they enforce a contract that states that you can't talk about anything for any unfold time. It's a very loose kind of wording for such a thing that they're potentially going to jail someone for. And then on top of that, what's the definition of confidential? You know, a lot of the information I've presented in this book isn't that new. It's just the way it's been presented is probably what's getting attention. And then there's just running a risk of saying, you know, would they actually want to make this any bigger? Because essentially what I'm saying is the truth. And if they're going to start prosecuting people for telling the truth, it's a very bad look for the government. And it will just bring more attention to this issue than, what they want. I have had friends been, intimidated by the Salvation Army for potentially speaking out, but again, it's never happened to me. That's not to say that something won't happen in the future. So I guess I was given the decision of, to just do it. And for me, it wasn't just going from nothing to writing a book. There were a lot of steps along the way without giving away too much in the book. I spoke in court while in Nauru against the security company who put in a statement when Julian Burnside made a case, a constitutional challenge against the existence of the camp, and the statement that the security company gave, I believe, was misleading, so I gave a statement back. And then I spoke out previously, and then this is, I guess, the third step. So, and the second question was the vacuum the Salvation Army would leave, and yeah, I'll try to speak up. Okay, so the second question was the Salvation Army leaving Nauru and what would happen, and who would take that space? And it's an interesting question, because I think the Salvation Army played a very important role, and or could have played a very important role having been there. And I think things like recreation programs and English classes and case management work were all very necessary, and the workers who did that were excellent, or some of them were. However, I think the organisation itself lacked the backbone, and in a place where they could have been using their role as a humanitarian organisation to push back and I guess tell the government, you know, we will drop the contract if you do not protect these men's rights. It actually became a reversal of that, where the government said, if you don't do what we say, we'll drop you from the contract. And when the Australian public were looking in Nauru saying, oh, but the Salvation Army was there, they're upholding human rights, essentially that's, I guess, what people would think of, and yet the Salvation Army was more worried about protecting their contract than they were about protecting the rights of the men, then I think there was a lot of issues for me. Having them go is difficult, because now you have an organisation like Transfield in charge, who is a security and logistics company in charge of the case management work and repair work and recreation work, which is, I guess, in direct contrast, direct contradiction to the responsibilities of a security company. But you still do, we still do have the organisation Save the Children assisting in some areas, and they're doing a good job from what I've heard. So the question was in regards to betraying, did I feel a sense of betrayal to my country by assisting the men, and was I ever pressured into doing work that I guess didn't reflect the actual work I was doing? So in my, when I first arrived, or I guess when the first case managers arrived in Nauru to do case management work with the men, there were maybe between 200 to 400 men and two case managers. So the idea of having a caseload of over 100 men and then expecting to write individual management plans and provide an ample amount of care for them is unplausible. I now work as a case manager and I have a caseload of 40 men and it's a lot of work. So to try and get 100 is just, it's ridiculous. So I would not be surprised if people were forced into that. I was my case manager, so I can't. As a certain amount happens. As a staff member of the Salvation Army in Nauru, we were told that our job was to go out and help the men. But the policy of no advantage was to create an atmosphere and a situation so bad that these people would not want to come to Australia and would prefer to stay at home. So already we're going against what the policy is, and the entire time I was there, I felt like I was fighting against my government, which is not what I wanted to be doing, but that was the role of my job. And by helping asylum seekers, we were on the wrong side. And I was accused of not having allegiance to my government when I told the truth in defence of the asylum seekers and didn't lie in defence of my government. So yes, it was a constant battle to say, am I betraying my government or am I helping the asylum seekers? Chris?
Yeah. I understand why people say about human rights. It's not political, but it is political. And Tony Abbott has made it political. He put the question of stopping the vote at the centre of politics. That the government will, you know, stand or fall on this. I mean, his response to the murder of Reza Barrage is before stopping the vote. It's about protecting the strength. And I think that gives you an idea of sort of the scale of the movement that we're going to need to build to be able to take Tony Abbott to task. But we know that we can do it because we've done it before. 2001, only 47% of people in Australia, according to the news poll, thought that asylum seekers should be able to come here. Was Palm Sunday relatively 30,000 on Palm Sunday. By 2004, that was up to 61% of people thought that asylum seekers should be able to come, and the movement shifted public opinion in that way. And John Howard didn't change his mind, but he did change his policy. He released children and long-term detainees under political pressure to try and placate some of the lukewarm opposition to his policy. And that's the kind of thing that we need to do again. We are having an impact. Protests matter. After the 10,000 who came on Palm Sunday, and by the way, 2,000 in Canberra, the biggest protest they've ever had there, it gives people confidence to go away and do other things. So you saw Christians occupying Billy Bishop's office and praying there. We got contacted at RAC. There are people who want to organise a circular in Amos Island. There are all sorts of things that come out of the protest. Oh, another part of shifting public opinion is challenging the lie that there is no view. It's not about this. So, you know, we can take several thousand UNHCR refugees to Indonesia, put them on a plane. We take 200,000 permanent migrants this year. This could be a problem. You know, economic migrants is a slur against refugees. All these sort of things. But we really need you. I mean, Ben said that we didn't have the leaflets here. When we're an organisation that follows here, sometimes these things fall through the cracks. Please get involved with the Refugee Action Collective. We meet every Monday night at 6:30. We need more people to build the sort of movement that is going to force Abbott to retreat. Thanks.
I have time for maybe just one more speaker. Priscilla?
And I appreciate the promise that we need to be united.
continue the applause going for our speakers as well. Thanks everyone for coming. Okay. Refreshments and stick around and chat.